Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Fanny Brewster speaking with you. Once again, we're doing Jung speaking, and today's reading will be from actually the symbolic life from volume 18, and we'll also have a selection from one of the other volumes from the collective work. Today, we're having a reading about Zen Buddhism. And so I'll begin reading to you from On the Discourses of the Buddha. These are Jung's words about that. It was neither the history of religion nor the study of philosophy that first drew me to the world of Buddhist thought, but my professional interest as a doctor. My task was the treatment of psychic suffering, and it was this that impelled me to become acquainted with the views and methods of that great teacher of humanity, whose principal theme was the chain of suffering, old age, sickness, and death. For although the healing of the sick naturally lies closest to the doctor's heart, he is bound to recognize that there are many diseases and states of suffering which, not being susceptible of a direct cure, demand from both patient and doctor some kind of attitude to their irremediable nature, even though it may not amount to actual incurability. In all such cases, there are inevitably phases of stagnation and hopelessness which seem unendurable and require treatment just as much as a direct symptom of illness. They call for a kind of moral attitude, such as is provided by religious faith or philosophical belief. In this respect, the study of Buddhist literature was of great help to me, since it trains one to observe suffering objectively and to take a universal view of its causes. According to tradition, it was by objectively observing the chain of causes that the Buddha was able to extricate his consciousness from the snares of the 10,000 things and to rescue his feelings from the entanglements of emotion and illusion. So also in our sphere of culture, the suffering and the sick can derive considerable benefit from this prototype of the Buddhist mentality, however strange it may appear. The Discourses of the Buddha, here presented by K.E. Neumann's new translation, have an importance that should not be underestimated. Quite apart from their profound meaning, their solemn, almost ritual form emits a penetrating radiance which has an exhilarating and exalting effect and cannot fail to work directly upon one's feelings. Against this use of the spiritual treasures of the East, it might be, and indeed often has been, objected from the Christian point of view that the faith of the West offers consolations that are at least as significant, and that there is no need to invoke the spirit of Buddhism with its markedly rational attitude. Aside from the fact that in most cases, the Christian faith of which people speak simply isn't there, and no one can tell how it might be obtained, special province of God. It is a truism that anything known becomes so familiar and hackneyed by frequent use that it gradually loses its meaning and hence its effect. Whereas anything strange and unknown and so completely different in its nature can open doors hitherto locked and new possibilities of understanding. If a Christian insists so much on his faith when it does not even help him to ward off the neuroses, then his faith is vain, and it is better to accept humbly what he needs, no matter where he finds it, if only it helps. There is no need for him to deny his religious convictions if he acknowledges his debt to Buddhism, for he is only following the Pauline injunction, prove all things, hold fast that which is good. To this good, which should be held fast, one must reckon the discourses of the Buddha, which have much to offer even to those who cannot boast of any Christian conviction. Offer Western man means and ways of disciplining his inner psychic life, thus remedying an often regrettable defect in the various brands of Christianity. The teachings of the Buddha can give him a helpful training when either the Christian ritual has lost its meaning or the authority of religious ideas has collapsed, as all too frequently happens in psychogenic disorders. People have often accused me of regarding religion as mental hygiene. Perhaps one may pardon a doctor his professional humility in not undertaking to prove the truth of metaphysical assertions and in shunning confessions of faith. I am content to emphasize the importance of having the therapeutic necessity of adopting some kind of attitude to the problem of psychic suffering. Suffering that is not understood is hard to bear, while on the other hand, it is often astounding to see how much someone can endure when he understands the why and the wherefore. A philosophical or religious view of the world enables him to do this, and such views prove to be, at the very least, psychic methods of healing, if not of salvation. Even Christ and his disciples did not scorn to heal the sick, thereby demonstrating the therapeutic power of their mission. The doctor has to cope with actual suffering for better or worse, and ultimately has nothing to rely on except the mystery of divine providence. It is no wonder, then, that he values religious ideas and attitudes so far as they prove helpful as therapeutic systems, and singles out the Buddha in particular, the essence of whose teaching is deliverance from suffering through the maximum development of consciousness as one of the supreme helpers on the road to salvation. From ancient time, physicians have sought a panacea, and their persistent efforts have unconsciously brought them nearer to the central ideas of the religion and philosophy of the East. Anyone who is familiar with methods of suggestion under hypnosis knows that plausible suggestions work better than those which run counter to the patient's own nature. Consequently, whether he liked it or not, the doctor was obliged to develop conceptions which corresponded as closely as possible with the actual psychological conditions. Thus, there grew up a realm of theory which not only drew upon traditional thought, but also took account of the unconscious products that compensated its inevitable one-sidedness. That is to say, all those psychic factors which Christian philosophy left unsatisfied. Among these were not a few aspects which, unknown to the West, have been developed in Eastern philosophy from very early times. So if, as a doctor, I acknowledge the immense help and stimulation I have received from the Buddhist teachings, I am following a line which can be traced back some 2,000 years in the history of human thought. That concludes the selection reading from that text. This reading is from Psychology and Religion, East and West, volume 11. It's an excerpt from the foreword to the introduction to Zen Buddhism. Every psychic process is an image and an imagining. Otherwise, no consciousness could exist, and the occurrence would lack phenomenality. Imagination itself is a psychic process, for which reason it is completely irrelevant whether the enlightenment be called real or imaginary. The person who has the enlightenment or alleges that he has it, thinks at all events that he is enlightened. when others think about it, decides nothing whatever for him in regard to his experience. Even if he were lying, his lie would still be a psychic fact. Indeed, even if all the reports of religious experiences were nothing but deliberate inventions and falsifications, a very interesting psychological treatise could still be written about the incidence of such lies, and with the same scientific objectivity with which one describes the psychopathology of delusional ideas. The fact that there is a religious movement upon which many brilliant minds have worked over a period of many centuries is sufficient reason for at least venturing a serious attempt to bring such process within the realm of scientific understanding. Earlier, I raised the question of whether we have anything like Satori in the West. If we discount the sayings of our Western mystics, a superficial glance discloses nothing that could be likened to it, even the faintest degree. The possibility that there are stages in the development of consciousness plays no role in our thinking. The mere thought that there is a tremendous psychological difference between consciousness of the existence of an object and consciousness of an object borders on a quibble that hardly needs answering. For the same reason, one could hardly bring oneself to take such a problem seriously enough to consider the psychological conditions in which it arose. It is significant that questions of this kind do not, as a rule, arise from any intellectual need, but where they exist, are nearly always rooted in originally religious practice. In India, it was yoga, and in China, Buddhism, which supplied the driving force for these attempts to wrench oneself free from bondage to a state of consciousness that was felt to be incomplete. So far as Western mysticism is concerned, its texts are full of instructions as to how man can and must release himself from the I-ness of his consciousness, so that thorough knowledge of his own nature, he may rise above it and attain the inner godlike man. John of Rosebrook makes use of an image which was also known to Indian philosophy, that of the tree whose roots are above and its branches below. And he quotes him, "And he must climb up into the tree of faith, which grows from above downwards, for its roots are in the Godhead," end quotes. He also says, like the yogi, man must be free and without ideas, released from all attachments and empty of all creatures. Be untouched by joy and sorrow, profit and loss, rising and falling, concern for others, pleasure and pain, and not be attached to any creature. It is in this that the utility of his being consists. And this means being turned inward. Being turned inwards means that a man is turned within. Into his own heart, that he may understand and feel the inner working and the inner words of God.